Good evening. Once again, this is Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my guest, my views, the views of our guests. And tonight our guest is Cal Grunwald, who's one of our supporters, and we're going to be talking about what's going on in the world economically. But before we get to that, I wanted to point out there's a fascinating article in the Asia Times for today. It's entitled Tough Flying for the Global Economy by Stephen Roach. Now, the name Stephen Roach may not mean much to many of you, but it should. He's the chief economist at Morgan Stanley and one of the most insightful intelligent individuals out there in the financial advisory field. And certainly about a year and a half ago, Stephen Roach, in a private meeting, was talking about his view on the economy. he said we had a 90% chance of having a financial collapse in America, that there was a 10% chance we'd be able to go along for a while. He didn't know when the collapse was coming, but he felt that sooner or later there was going to be a financial collapse. Well, in the article that was published, actually it's dated October the 26th, which actually is tomorrow, but the Asia Times, and of course you'll find so many wonderful things in the Asia Times. Stephen Rhodes talks about a 747. He uses the analogy of a 747, a gigantic airplane lumbering through the sky, which is the global economy, but it's only flying not on four engines, but on two engines. And one is China, and that is the production engine, and the other is the United States, which is the consumption engine. Because, despite everything else going on in the world, America's consumption is what's really fueling the world, and China's production is what's fueling the United States, and in other words, filling all the needs that we have. And as long as China keeps producing, well, it can only keep producing as long as America really continues consuming. And, of course, we've had a wonderful ride. We have all this money that we made during the stock market boom, and those who got out before it collapsed did well. And, of course, they have a lot of money that they can invest. And then, of course, when the stock market collapsed, then we had the housing boom. And we've had a wonderful ride with the housing boom. And even if you didn't sell your house, you could always go out and borrow money. And so many people did. And they simply monetized their house. They made money out of their house. It was simply like a money machine. And you could keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. And the interest rates weren't too high. And you had all that money to spend. And so people have been buying and buying and buying and buying a lot of things they didn't need, but, in fact, we're buying far more than we're actually making. We've been on a buying binge here for a number of years, but now, of course, that buying binge is beginning to disappear because we see the increase in the price of heating oil and natural gas and electricity and gasoline, and this is going to soak up a great deal of the money that otherwise would have gone into consumption. And then we see falling wages. Certainly we see pension funds beginning to implode. We find that many of the retired people are going to have to put out more money for their own health insurance now. And, of course, if you're out in the labor market competing, you're competing with illegal aliens who will work for half of what you'll work for. And certainly in many cities, they just don't have the financial base anymore. And cities all across America are laying off employees because they just don't have the money. And, we begin to see America's economy faltering, and suddenly you see the 747. And soon it may only be flying on one engine, and that is Chinese production. And you can't keep producing if you can't sell. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Cal Grunwald, and we're going to talk about what will happen to that 747 when the engines don't function. Well, Cal, how are you tonight?
Well, just fine. Stan, how are you?
I'm doing just great. And I don't know whether you saw that article by Stephen Rhodes, but he's certainly one of my favorite writers, one of the few people I really pay a lot of attention to what he says. And certainly we begin to see our economy faltering. We begin to see the price really of gold and silver going up. And, just within even the last couple of days, they simply have taken a surge forward. It's almost as if people in America are beginning to sense that something's seriously wrong. What's your take on it?
Well, that's very true. A lot of people that used to be asleep are now waking up, and of course, the bankers are still suppressing the price of gold immensely. Even it's at, finished at 473 today, but they're buying now. People are buying that have been sitting on the fence for many, many years. Silver finished at $7.80 today. So I think it is finally kind of getting into people's minds that they better do something before they can't. And, of course, gold is reacting to the falling dollar, the bad economy, and that's what it's supposed to be doing. And it's a good thing. I just hope it slows down a little bit, because if it continues at its pace the last 2 months, I think we're going to see a panic, and I don't want that to happen.
Well, it's really very interesting. One of the articles we pulled down off the Internet today was out of India, and you get a lot of interesting things out of the India internet, and of course they have an internet, and they were saying that between India and China, they're consuming 80% of all the gold that is being mined today. And the Indians, of course, do not want to go out and spend a lot of money. They're very thrifty people. They don't trust a fiat money system, so they are investing in gold. They're not out buying all the fancy cars, although there has certainly been an increase in consumption over there. But an awful lot of Indians are saving. They're not putting money in the bank. They're buying gold, and they're consuming, between India and China, 80% of all the gold that is mined in the world today, which doesn't leave very much for the people here. In fact, I suspect that actually the supplies of the central banks and those other supplies that may be around the world certainly are beginning to decline. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's very very astute observation, and it is shocking to hear that, but it is not surprising, because the people in China, the Oriental people, and the people in India, they've always known the value of gold, and they cherish it, and they buy it whenever they can. And certainly now, with worldwide production of gold being the lowest it's been since 1931, it's not a surprise that these people who really know.
Hold that thought right there, Cal. We'll be right back with our other station. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Cal Grunwald, and Cal is one of our supporters, and he's with us about once a month, and we simply talk about what's happening economically. And as I was saying during the break, there's an article on the internet that comes out of India, pointing out that the Indians are consuming, between India and China, they're consuming 80% of all the gold that is produced and mined in the world every year now. And the Indians and the Chinese are frugal. They are saving. Of course, the Americans aren't saving. We're just spending as if the good times are going to go on forever. But there's a great deal that's beginning to suggest that the good times are coming to an end. And even Alan Greenspan, this last week, when he was talking to an audience over in Japan, saying that the increase in the cost of energy, talking about heating oil, electricity, natural gas, and certainly gasoline and oil and diesel and the jet fuel, all of this is going to cause prices to go far higher, and has begun to soak up the excess money that we had to buy all these products. And as a result, we're not going to be able to buy as a nation as much as we have in the past. And I think that is going to certainly seriously influence the world economy. And if America stops consuming, then where will the rest of the world sell? So pick up the story there, Cal.
Well, I agree. And as you have indicated already, 70% of our economy is consumption. And so Americans basically, that's why General Motors, posted a $3 billion loss the first quarter. And Ford is way down. The Japanese manufacturers are up because they're making, excellent cars. The Lexus is... Even the Lexus is a better car than the Cadillac right now. It's a sad state of affairs, but this is what's happening. And as you mentioned, the pension funds of these big companies are drying up. So when people do retire, there won't be anything there.
And I think this is really one of the cruelest jokes of all time. All these people who work for General Motors and Ford and Delphi and United Airlines and Northwest Airlines and so many of the major companies are simply going to default on their pension funds, turn them over to the pension benefit guarantee corporations to pay 30 or 40% on the pensions, and with inflation those pensions may not be worth much of anything. And this is all a direct result of the unions demanding such excesses amount of money, from General Motors, who eventually gave in and said, sure, we'll go ahead then and pay the retiree these fantastic amounts of money. We'll provide them free health care, and they can retire at 50, and they can have this big pension, and they can have their health care taken care of, and their drugs taken care of until they're 65. And General Motors doesn't have the money to do it. And actually, many of the retirees have had to begin providing at least part of their health care benefits. They've already been guaranteed. But the truth of the matter is that the unions have betrayed the workers, and they've certainly made the concessions to General Motors with the threat that if you don't do that, we're just going to go into bankruptcy, and you're going to lose everything. And I think that the cutback in health care benefits for the retirees of General Motors is certainly just the first step. Certainly the people of the employees at Delphi, about 35,000 members of the United Auto Workers, stand to lose really everything, their pensions, their health care, everything, and their jobs as well.
That's why when I talk to people, I encourage them, before it's too late, you know, take a look at some of the electronic money you've got out there in your IRAs and your 401ks. There's a lot of companies that allow you to borrow half against your 401k and put it into gold and silver, something tangible or food, something that it's going to be of use to you and a value, extreme value down the road, not too short of a future. So people are, you know, most people are still somehow think that it's going to turn around and we're going to come out of this, but we are not going to come out of this. A very interesting comment about the new Fed chairman, his name is Bernanke.
Right.
I was talking to my main supplier today, and he said that's why gold jumped $7 today. You know, and his announcement today or yesterday is because this man has made quite a few negative comments about the dollar and the falling dollar, and he doesn't care, and he has no intention of doing anything about it. And so the people who know that, when he was appointed, that's why gold jumped the way it did, because he's not for rescuing the dollar.
Well, I think it's very interesting that Alan Greenspan is going to retire in January, and I think, of course, you know what the rats do when the ship is going down. They get off, and I think Alan Greenspan has had a great run, and I think he knows exactly where we're headed, and he doesn't want to be at the helm of the ship when it hits the iceberg. So, you know, and Bernanke, certainly if you read what he's written, I don't think he has any grasp at all of the implications of where we are. He's talking about traditional, you know, manipulation of the economy by the Federal Reserve System. They've been able to do it in the past, but eventually you have too many balls to juggle. And you can juggle 3 balls, 4 balls, 5 balls, 6 balls, but when you got to juggle 20 balls at one time, nobody can do it. And I don't think the Federal Reserve has either the capacity or the intelligence to do it. I think the only thing that can really rescue this whole thing is going to be a total collapse and then building again. That's what's always happened in the past. It happened in ancient Greece, which is why Aristotle, facing a fiat money system in ancient Greece, said there's absolutely nothing wrong with fiat money. As long as you have perfect authority and godlike wisdom and kings, there's nothing new under the sun. You know, Cal, but it's amazing, the average American has no concept of history. The same thing happened under Diocletian in Rome in 300 A.D. Exactly the same thing that's going on in America today. In fact, Diocletian slapped on wage and price controls and made it a capital offense, you know, to sell something for more than the government said, or to buy it for something more than the government said, and they would execute you if you tried to, you know, charge more than the government said you could for products. And eventually the whole system collapsed, and Diocletian retired and went off to raise cabbages, because he realized, of course, there was nothing he could do to control the economy that he had destroyed.
Well, that's very interesting, Dr. Stan, and of course, you're a student of history, and very few people are students of history. They just choose to watch the tube and read the local newspaper, which is all opinions and lies anyway, so they'll just never come out of it. But I am noticing, as I mentioned before, that some people are waking up, and they are doing something about it, but it's pretty frightening to me, considering what's happening. I know I referenced this before in several broadcasts ago, that, you know, the Muslim world is uniting against us because of what George is over there, you know, grabbing oil and killing thousands of innocent people. But the Muslim world is united to hurt us, and how better than to hurt our currency. And a couple months ago, the Saudi Arabia converted 368 billion American dollars into euros and yen, and that hit the dollar very, very hard. And of course, it's recovered some, but it's only temporary. And about a week later, Saudi Arabia, you know, canceled our oil contract and gave it to China. So those are critical things that, of course, the media will never tell you. And it's on the way down. Where, you know, our economy, of course, now oil is going way up. You had a very interesting letter about oil. I read today, your newsletter, Dr. Stan, and very, very good good newsletter.
Oh, you're talking about my latest newsletter. Yes, yes, any of our listeners would like to get a copy of that. It just goes into the peak oil scam. Not that it matters whether it's real or whether it's put on. The thing is, we are going to have difficult times. They are not going to develop the oil reserves we have. They're not going to develop the natural gas reserves we have. They're not going to build the pipelines that they should build. They're not going to open the refineries, at least even if they start today to build the refineries. It'll be, you know, several years before those refineries are in place. And all of this has been created artificially. But we're going to still have to live with the disastrous results of the environmental movement restriction of development of oil and development of oil refineries and the development of natural gas facilities and the development of nuclear energy in this country, the plan of which has been financed by the oil industry, by our corporations, by our great tax-exempt foundations, who are headed by people who have a different vision of the world. They believe in a ruling elite. They believe in globalism. They believe in building up the economy of the rest of the world and impoverishing the American people. And when you understand that, then everything begins to make sense. Because if you look at things from a logical point of view and our open borders, and you say, why did this happen? It becomes pretty obvious that it is happening on purpose. We could close the borders. We could stop the illegal immigration and the lowering of our living standards if they wanted to. But our leaders have a different agenda, but they're not going to tell us what the real plan is, because the people would be furious if they realize that they were transferring our wealth and our factories and our jobs to other countries intentionally. So I really think the threat of globalism is something that most people do not understand, that nothing happens by accident.
No, that's right. One thing I do when I talk to people is present to them, of course, as you know, history. In 1933, Roosevelt confiscated gold and, you know, took real money out of people's hands and pockets and gave them paper in exchange. And so now that paper has traveled its length and is failing. It's, you know, dropped 50% in value in the last 3 years. But people, just because they've been conditioned, you know, by the media, by Wall Street, you know, to invest, and we have banks, we have brokerage firms, we have the stock market, we have insurance companies. All these are institutions that we have been taught to trust. The problem is that we are trusting these fickle institutions that are not loyal to us. We're trusting them with our wealth.
You're absolutely right. We're going to be back in just a moment or two with Cal Grunwald. And we're going to, of course, welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Cal, why don't you pick up the story there? Certainly, I share your concern. I think that the American people are going to have to realize that they are going to have to look after themselves. And one of the biggest problems is the American people don't have much in the way of savings. They've got their money in their pension funds, but those pension funds, certainly if they are being managed by many of these corporate managers, you know, their corporate managers aren't interested in building up the equity of the average individual. They're interested in building up their own equity. And have you noticed that so many times when the major banks and stockbrokers firms have cheated people out of literally hundreds of millions of dollars, nobody ever goes to prison? But certainly a few of the corporate heads like Enron and Global Crossing and Tyco, they're going to prison. But, you know, the people within the banking industry and the stock industry and the mutual funds who cheated people, they never go to prison. They pay a little fine that the government keeps, and the people never get their money back.
No, that's true. In fact, I've talked to a number of brokers that used to be stockbrokers and people who work for insurance companies. They all tell a very interesting tale. Those who at least are willing to tell the truth is that they are all taught that when people come to invest their money or put it, you know, in a brokerage firm or insurance company, maybe they get an annuity or something like that, or put money in a bank, these people are instructed you know, to say, to say, you know, this is our money now, not to the people, they don't say, but they're saying, this belongs to our institution, it no longer belongs to the client, and that's the way you have to treat them. So if they want to get it out of there, you have to get, you know, you use any tactic in the book, you know, you can intimidate them, coerce them, you know, lie to them, whatever you need to do to keep that money in our house, we don't want them to have it back. And so this is what the tactics, if you talk to your insurance agent, I'd say 99% of them, insurance agents, brokers, they're going to fight with the customer, they're going to lie to them, they're going to coerce them, they're going to, you know, browbeat them to, well, just diversify, put it in this other fund or switch it from one hand to another, but don't give it to the person. And again, the banks, you go into a bank, you know, you want $5,000 or $10,000 out of the bank, they don't have it. You got to, you know, you have to submit a writing and, you know, fill out a form saying I want my cash, and you wait 5 days or 10 days, or, you know, back when Roosevelt confiscated gold, there was a 60-day rule imposed. You couldn't get any cash unless you submitted your request in writing, and 6 days later you'd get it. So we're headed for that again, and you know, there's people, they don't think anything of it. They say, well, that's the system and I have to live with it, but they don't realize, and, you know, the implications of it. In 1921, the banks in this country had 21 cents on the dollar from deposit for withdrawals. And you know what happened in the 29 crash. You know, hardly anybody got their money. You know, people just were bankrupted. So now, the banks have 2 cents on the dollar on deposit for withdrawals. You know, they have hardly any cash. That's why you can't get any out of the bank when you go there.
Well, of course, the FDIC supposedly has the money. The Federal Deposit Insurance Company is going to guarantee that. The only trouble is that the Federal Deposit Insurance Company doesn't have enough money to, if there really were a bank run, to do anything about it.
No, in fact, the truth of the matter is they have 0.16 cents on the dollar, less than the banks. They don't have any reserves. Of course, you know, they're neither federal nor they have any reserves. And people, you know, people trust the mutual funds. They're supposed to, by law, keep 7 cents on the dollar on deposit for withdrawals, but in reality, they only have 3 cents on the dollar.
Hold that thought right there. We're going to bring other stations back on board right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our whole financial system is built on banking, and banking is built upon trust. But can we really trust the banks? The banking industry is really a wonderful scam. They create money out of nothing. They take your money, they lend it out, and the money really isn't there. And when you want to get your money, well, of course, most people aren't going to go to the bank to get their money out, but... And, of course, you can't get a run on the bank because they'll just close the bank if too many people want to come at one time. But everybody trusts the banking system. Nobody in this country can imagine that we could get into real problems with our banks. And yet, of course, it's happened time and time and time again down through the ages. And the trouble is people don't know history. We've got Brad calling from Freewater, Oregon. Hi, Brad. How are you doing? Oh, let's see. Brad, are you there?
Well, you know, just listening to your talk here just now, I have a concept for you about bankers, and we call those banksters.
Okay, what did you want to say?
No. No, it sounds like we're totally bypassing what happened in Germany with the hyperinflation at 16 million percent a year, and we're just going to go right to just shutting the whole shebang down.
Well, let's hope and pray it doesn't get that bad. But you certainly can get into an inflationary spiral. And I believe as things begin to fall apart, the Fed has two choices, either to let them fall apart or to inflate the money supply. And it's going to be very interesting to see what they do.
Well, it sounds like this new money man that's taken Greenspan's place has got his head in the sand a little deeper than Greenspan.
Well, I think Greenspan was brilliant, right? But I'm really very, very worried about the man who's going to replace him. After all, of course, look at the people that George Bush has appointed so far. Albert Gonzalez, Harriet Myers, you know, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, you know, and look where he's gotten us. He's gotten us into a war that's never going to end in the Middle East. I mean, he has actually created tremendous problems as far as, you know, the deficit, the largest deficits that we've ever had here in the United States have been gotten under George Bush. Can we really trust his judgment to put somebody good into the Federal Reserve System?
Well, I'm just wondering why a white man thinks he can sort out an Arab problem that's been going on for, you know, 5,000, 6,000 years.
What are your thoughts on that, Cal?
Well, again, it's, I don't know if we have an air problem as much as we do a problem of greed, you know, with George. All it is about oil over there. And we have no business getting in their matters, you know. They didn't do anything to us. And of course, we rehashed all this about weapons of mass destruction, which didn't exist. Anyway, and so it was just an oil grab. The Muslim world knows that, and that's why they're so incensed. That's why their intent to kill Americans. That's why their intent to, you know, wage war against us.
Well, I think, Brad, the significant thing is that the real reason we're over there is we want to chase our troops there permanently, and that's why we're not doing anything to end what's going on over there. If we wanted to end this whole thing, we would simply, it'll let the Shias have their country, and the Kurds have their country, and the Sunni Muslims have their country, and would pull our troops out, and we could be home, you know, within 30 days. We do not want a solution. We want a problem, because if there was peace and stability over there, how would we justify permanently occupying Iraq? That's
well,
what
you
it's
know,
about.
If we pulled all of our troops in from the world, I think that would resolve a lot of the federal government's financial difficulties.
You're absolutely right. Anything that you want to ask our guest this evening?
No.
All right, Brad, I think you're absolutely right. But, of course, there is a different agenda. The people in charge really want America to dominate the world and to bring the entire world under the control of a one-world government. And, of course, this new world religion that they are dedicated to. So, I mean, it would be nice to say, well, if we could only pull our troops home, if we could only, you know, find the peaceful solution in Iraq, we're not going to do it. Anyway, our job is to let people understand what the real agenda is, and thanks very much for calling.
Yeah, thank you for your show. I've listened to it for years, thanks.
Thank you. So, anyway, of course, Cal, you can't separate what's happening internationally and the massive debts we're incurring with the war over in Iraq, and the massive debts we're incurring, you know, from giving money to countries throughout the world, and the massive money we're spending on keeping our troops stationed throughout the world. Why do we still have, you know, troops stationed in Japan 60 years after the Second World War ended, and in Germany 60 years after the Second World War ended, and in Korea 50 years after the Korean War ended? Why are our troops really stationed there? And they don't want to tell the American people that the invisible government has an imperial program for America to dominate the world. And until people begin to understand that there is a disconnect between what we are told and what the government really intends, the government could stop illegal immigration tomorrow. The government could bring spending under control and the deficits under control tomorrow. They have no intention of doing it. We're going to be back in just a couple of minutes here with Cal Grunewald, talking about what's really going on in the world today. Well, Dr. Stan, here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Cal Grunewald. And Cal, you were just saying there seems to be a lot more interest in people buying gold and silver today than there was.
Oh, definitely. You know, gold has gone up about $50 in the last 6 weeks. And people are paying a lot of attention. I was mentioning before about, you know, when I talk to people, I talk to them about the risks that they're taking and having leaving their money where it is, because it's not under their control. It's in the banks. It's in stocks or bonds or brokerage firms or insurance companies and annuities. It's everywhere else except, you know, in their hands. And I was mentioning that the mutual funds, you know, that's over half the money in the stock market. Mutual funds are required by law to keep 7 cents on the dollar on deposits for withdrawals, but they only have 3 cents in reality. So if there's even a small run on the mutual funds, it'll bring the market down because they're going to shut the doors and not allow that. Of course, the government will always be way ahead.
Well, of course, right now, of course, there's really no evidence that the average American really realizes what's happening. I find it difficult to believe that the average American's going to run down and try to get their money out of the bank. They think it's in the bank. It's just as safe as if it were in their pocket. But then, of course, they really think that the paper money or the bank records that they are, the bank entries, really are some value. But it's really only a bank entry. The real money that has been for thousands and thousands of years has been gold and silver. They just don't want the American people to know that.
That's right.
And in fact, if gold is of no value, why are the central banks hanging on to the gold? Why does every major country in the world have a supply of gold behind their currency if paper money is as good as gold?
Yeah, that's good. Well, that's a question nobody asked, and you know, certainly the media is not going to pose that. In fact, I was looking the other day for a quote, you know, on a gold quote, and I couldn't even find it in a newspaper. So now they're ignoring it. They don't want to let people know that it exists.
And isn't it? But have you noticed that when gold and silver move up very, very sharply on the markets, it is never mentioned in the financial section of our evening television?
Wouldn't want to tell that to the people. They might get the idea that it's valuable.
You know? And I'll tell you what, you can tell when it's at the top, because that's when they start talking about it every night. That's the time when you should be selling, not buying. But when you should be buying, they're not pointing it out. When you should be selling, why they're encouraging to buy. That's the way the game's played. And the rich get richer and the poor get poor.
Well, as we were talking about, you know, closing the banks, and of course they can do that with a phone call, and then all the banks are shut. And, what's one of the documents that I'm offering in my free package is called the Emergency Banking Order.
Hold that thought. I'm going to let you tell our listeners about that in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Cal Grunwald. And Cal has a packet that he offers people, really going into what really happened in 1933, because you have to understand the history of the past. So, Cal, what do you actually offer people if they, you offer that free of charge, isn't it?
Yes.
What's in that packet? What documents will they get?
I've written a 26-page paper entitled Gold and How to Avoid the Scams in the Coin Industry. And, of course, unfortunately, the coin industry is unregulated, and it's pretty much buyer beware. And it happens to be the gold business happens to be a haven for charlatans and vultures. And there are some honest people out there, but they're few and far between. So I've written a paper exposing the scams in the coin industry. It's meant to be an educational piece. I don't name any names or companies, which is for obvious reasons. But it's the principle of the thing. So that paper I am offering free of charge. And then also there's another document called the Emergency Banking Order, which was drafted in 1961 by Robert Anderson, who was the Secretary of the Treasury at the time. It basically allows the banks in the time of national emergency or war to close their doors. Credit unions, banks, any kind of financial institution. And they are only required to give people enough for essential living expenses and taxes, things like that. But, when push comes to shove, they probably won't do that, as they didn't in Argentina either. So then there's some articles out of the 1933 New York Times when Roosevelt confiscated gold. He talked about the new banking rules that he instituted. There are 14 of them. The second one on the list is opens safety deposit boxes. And I've heard some real horror stories, which I relate in my paper. Well, what happened to people back then, to their valuables and their gold coins and their silver coins and everything else that was in their safety deposit boxes. And I've talked to three people in the last 3 years who've had things taken out of their safety deposit boxes, if you can believe that, and I do. So all those documents are there. There's an interesting account of a ship. One of the bankers was shipping their gold coins. He was a little bit late. He was shipping his gold coins overseas to avoid the confiscation, and he got caught. There was $9 million worth of gold coins on that shipment. The boat was called the Paris. So it's a very, very interesting package of information. And then there's the last article addresses the Fort Knox gold situation. There is no gold in Fort Knox, and it tells a very interesting story of what happened to it. And of course, along with that is the stark reality that we have, as you mentioned, Dr. Stan, every country has gold, in their central bank vaults backing up their currency. We have none. Absolutely none. There's nothing backing our dollar except confidence.
All right, well, how can people get in touch with you? What's your telephone number there?
My telephone number is 414-234-8267. That's 414-234-8267. And I'll be glad to send you my paper at no charge, no obligation, I won't browbeat you. I used to be a high school and college English teacher, so I do everything through education.
All right, fine. Well, I think it's important that people really get the information about what's going on today and begin thinking about where we go from here. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But it looks to me as if the economy has turned the corner. Now, if you notice, this, they've been keeping the Dow Jones up just a little over 10,000, somewhere between 10,000 and 10,500. You have to realize this is all manipulated. It is manipulated by something known as the Plunge Protection Team. It's perfectly legal because there's an executive order that gives them the permission to manipulate the Dow Jones average. Why do they do that? Because it has to do with perception. It has to do with your view of what's happening in the stock market. Now, the Dow Jones does not reflect what's happening in the overall stock market. It reflects what's happening to 30 stocks, 30 or 40 stocks, you know, that make up the Dow Jones average. And so it's very easy to manipulate those in a similar manner to manipulate the perception of the average individual. And when the market is going up, most people feel good. When the market's going down, most people feel bad. But they want to control your thoughts. And if they can control your thoughts, they can control your actions. And you're not going to be, of course, making the preparations for the difficult times that lie ahead, because you don't really believe that's going to happen, because the Dow Jones is staying up there just about the same level. When the time comes, of course, they'll let the Dow Jones fall. When they want to create a deflationary psychology, when they want to create fear in your hearts. Or perhaps at times things get out of hand and they don't have enough money, but they have close to $100 billion they use to manipulate the market. Where did the money come from? The government creates it out of nothing. It's absolute paper money. It's all bank entries. And so often the market will be down maybe $100 for, 100 points for the day. And then just in the closing 10 minutes, all these orders will come in from some strange unknown sources in the Cayman Islands to actually get the market back up where they want to keep it to control the perception of the American people. And until people understand that our minds are molded, our tastes are formed, our ideas are suggested largely by people we've never heard of, we can't understand what's going on. And those words were written by Edward Bernays back in 1929. Edward Bernays, the master propagandist who was hired by Lucky Strike to convince women they should smoke, and by the U.S. Public Health Service to convince us that fluoride wasn't a poison, it was a panacea, and we could have perfect smiles and pretty smiles through perpetuity if we just put this deadly poison into our drinking water. So it's amazing what they can do to the psyche of the American people. But until we understand that we are being manipulated, we will continue to be manipulated. Once we can think independently and begin studying history and understanding what is really going on, we can begin making whatever preparations we can to protect ourselves and our families. Well, Cal, what do you recommend that people actually would get at this present time? How do you feel about people saying laying in a supply of silver? Is that a good idea or not?
Well, it's an excellent idea, and in fact, I was going to talk rather in depth about that tonight in a very practical way. My approach to gold and silver is entirely practical. That is, if we can picture ourselves, which we don't want to do any of us, down the road when the dollar finally collapses, well, how are we going to function? And how are things going to work? And I fashion my approach around that concept because, you know, that is going to be reality sooner or later. And that's why I recommend silver, first of all, because you have to have something to barter with. There are a lot of proponents out there of, you know, strictly going with gold, but, gold coins and things like that. Gold is fine, but it has to be in its place. There's a lot of people out there that don't have much money, but they do have money enough that they can get a little bit of silver. And I recommend the 90% silver. It's called junk silver. These are the coins that were minted and were legal tender in our country from 1913 to 1964, and the dimes, quarters, and half dollars. Now, I recommend a bag of silver that's 55 pounds. A bag per household. If you can't afford a bag, you can get a half a bag, a quarter bag, or eighth bag. I mean, there's nothing says you have to have the money for the whole bag. But I give a very practical explanation of how you could use these silver coins in barter situations once the dollar collapses. And it's all numbers. It makes a lot of sense to me. And again, when I talk to people about buying gold and silver, it has to make sense in order for people to buy it. If they can't understand it, that's why people can't understand these high mint state coins that cost 6-7 times what an ounce of gold does. And people can't understand, bars of silver, 100-ounce bars. They can't understand that either, because how are you going to use it? So there's a lot of things that people can understand. So I give a very practical explanation that once silver, once a dollar collapses, say silver gets to $50 an ounce, which it certainly will, because in 1980 it hit $53 an ounce. At the same time, gold was $850 an ounce. But I use $50 an ounce as kind of a benchmark. So if you take, very simple way, if you take the silver content of a mercury dime or a dime times the price per ounce for silver, say it's $50 an ounce, the silver content of a mercury dime is 0.07 of an ounce, not quite a tenth of an ounce. So if you multiply that silver content times $50 an ounce, you get $3.50. Now, that would be the value of that coin as far as purchasing power on the street. So if a loaf of bread is $3 or $4 a loaf, or a dozen eggs or a gallon of milk or whatever it is, with a dime you can buy that and you won't have to worry about getting change. If you have a 100-ounce bar of silver and you go to try to do the same transaction, how's it going to work? It won't. So, in like manner, the 25-cent piece, the quarter, it contains 0.18 of an ounce of silver, not quite a fifth of an ounce. So 0.18 times $50 is $9. So if you have a quarter, it's worth $9 on the street based on the $50 an ounce value. A 50-cent piece has 0.366 of an ounce of silver times $50. An ounce is $18.30.
Well, again, I think that once people, begin to realize, of course, that silver has intrinsic values, it's had, for thousands and thousands of years. And remember, of course, the story of the 30 pieces of silver at the time of Christ. They were so valuable. I mean, this was worth the man's life. This was really a fortune, and Judas was willing to betray our Lord for silver. But silver has always been valuable, as is gold, but silver is never quite as valuable. And so let's right now go to Kevin, who's calling us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Kevin, did you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, hi, Dr. Monteith. Just love listening to you.
Are you listening on shortwave internet or one of those?
Internet, live internet.
Okay, very good.
Makes it worth getting a computer for. And it's like an education. Listening to you is a true education. It's great. You cover so many subjects. I'm real excited. I listen to Alex Jones too in Austin, and he shares a lot of your guests and everything, so it's cool.
Right, Alex does a great, great job.
He's great. Yeah, I met him in person, and I think he's just a real genuine guy, and
he sure is.
He gets okay, but I'll stay on subject with you. I inherited a little money, and not much, but some money. And I was wondering about the shifting over to gold or something. Your guest Cal was talking. I guess he was just at that point when I started listening.
All right, Cal. What would you like to ask him specifically?
Specifically, what do you do? Say, I have money in a bank. I have, say, $30,000 to play with. Would you recommend just getting bullion coins, or I'm afraid the number. Yeah, what do you call those other ones? A numismatic.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't say it.
Let's get Cal's idea about numismatic and collectible coins, and then in contrast to gold bullion coins.
Okay. Yeah, what was your first name?
Kevin.
Kevin. Okay, Kevin. Well, see, I explained this in my paper at length. One of the biggest scams out there in the gold coin industry are these numismatic coins, these high mint state coins, MS64, 65, 66s, that are for collectors only. These are not for people that are looking like you to preserve some wealth and have something, later on that they can say, this is my financial stability.
Yeah.
And you're never going to be able to recoup your money out of that, because you can pay $4,000 to $6,000 to $7,000 for these $20 liberties, which are 1-ounce coins, you're never going to get your money out of it. You're even break even unless gold gets that per ounce. So they're a huge ripoff. So don't go there.
Okay.
But I do recommend like a bag of silver. I was kind of explaining how you could determine the value of a silver coin, a dime, quarter, or a half dollar, or even a silver dollar on the street if silver were $50 an ounce. And of course, gold. Once you have your bag of silver, if you're a married man and have a family, that's first and foremost, your barter is going to be those silver coins. Mm-hmm. And then the money that you want to preserve after that, you should consider, gold. I recommend, some bullion coins like 1/10 ounce American Eagles or Maple Leafs. I also recommend the very low grades, the $10 and $20 Liberties. The extra fines are almost uncirculated because the premium is relatively close to spot, and so those coins still have the protection of being private, non-confiscatable, although there's a big debate about whether the government is going to be honorable in anything anymore, but those coins have a really tremendous upside potential. Not that I stress that, but I would encourage you to call me up and get my paper, because it is quite an education. Not that I'm not bragging about what I wrote, but it's just It is an eye-opener to a lot of people, because the coin industry is kind of secretive and, it's hard to find out anything about it. And I guess from what people have told me, I'm the only one that's ever exposed it.
Okay. Do you have a website, Cal?
No, I don't.
Okay, I'll call your number. Thank you for that.
Okay, fine.
Thanks, Dr. Stan.
Thanks very much. Good talking to you, Kevin. Let's get that telephone number up one more time, Cal.
Yes, it's 414-234-8255. 267. That's 414-234-8267. And I can't say it enough that I really enjoy talking to people just in an educational way. I don't believe in high pressure. I hate it. I talk to people all the time who are scammed by these coin companies, and every time I hear, somebody high pressured me, or they were so obnoxious, they tried to get me to buy now, and they made up a story about, I got this estate, and if it's not sold today, it's gonna be going to somebody else. It just makes me sick to hear these stories, but there's very few honest people out there in the gold business, and that's what's disturbing to me. So I'd be glad to just talk with people. That's all I do, is talk with people and present, this is how it is. And then I always ask people, what do you have or what don't you have? Because I do, honestly, I turn a lot of people away when I find out that they don't have enough money to... You've got to have discretionary money to put in gold and silver. You can't take money that's earmarked for bills, food, or something like that. You can't. You can't do it.
You've got to have a certain amount of money on hand just to meet the ordinary requirements if something came up. And then, of course, I think that Cal's absolutely right that, it's really something to give you financial security, and that's what it is. And you put it aside, and you're not looking to make a profit on it. You're looking to secure what you have. And this is the big thing. It is that if you do not make preparations, we could see happening in America what's happening in Rhodesia today, where they have 400% inflation a year. And, of course, dollar, the rand over there, which used to be, I guess they call it a dollar, used to be about two American dollars to one Rhodesian dollar, and now I think it's about 25,000 Rhodesian dollars to one American dollar, and that's over a period of about, we betrayed Rhodesia in 1980, over a period of 25 years. They've just destroyed the value of everything the Rhodesian people have. Of course, who destroyed it? Why, the American State Department that put a lifelong communist named Robert Mugabe, who was trained as a Maoist in China. We brought him to power in Rhodesia. We just have to ask, why would our State Department do something like that? And if they do that to Rhodesia, would they do it to America? Well, our guest is Cal Grunwald this evening. Cal, do you have an associate, or you work by yourself?
No, I do. In fact, I'm getting so busy. I put on an associate. His name is Glenn Parker. So
okay, fine.
You can call him too if you like. That's in my message. If you don't get me,
all right, fine. Well, basically, of course, we've talked this evening about what people need to think about doing, And certainly, I think that people have to begin watching very, very closely what's going on. And there are certainly conflicting reports out there as to what should be done. And whether you should get, you know, the collectibles, or whether you should get the numismatic. But I think the basic thing is you certainly want to protect yourself, and you don't want to think of things that are way over the price of gold. Would that be a fairly statement, a fairly good statement?
Well, that's right. That's right. And that's part of my practical approach. You know, you don't want to pay much over what you really need to get the protection. So there are advantages and disadvantages of all things. But of course, you really do want to watch. Don't ever get involved in buying the real high mint state coins or foreign gold coins that these coin companies misrepresent as, you know, collectibles and non-confiscatable, because foreign gold coins are considered bullion in the eyes of our government, and they can be confiscated. So that's why, you know, I point these things out in my paper. I also talk about a lot of people are, you know, have gold or silver IRAs, and that's not any advantage either, because number one, you converted your money into gold and silver, but you can only buy bullion, which can be confiscated, and then it has to be stored in a bank somewhere in this country. So when they close the bank doors, forget it. They're going to take your gold, and you'll never even see it go. So that's not a good idea either. So if you want to convert a gold IRA, it's a simple process. You can talk to me, you know, on the phone, and I'm going to walk you through it. That way you can convert that gold IRA into something practical, and then above all, have it in your possession. And that's key. You must have your wealth in your possession in a tangible form.
Well, I think that history records that fiat money systems always, sooner or later, whether, you know, with a bang or with a whimper, they eventually collapse. And this is what Paul Volcker said in his article that he had, I think it was the 10th of April of this year, in the Washington Post. And he feels we're heading towards a financial collapse. Stephen Rhodes feels that same way. Certainly Warren Buffett has talked about where we stand with debentures. He calls them financial weapons of mass destruction, are currently latent but potentially lethal. Cal Grunwald, thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night and God bless. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay, fine. Well, that's Cal, and he's been with us. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening has been Cal Grunwald, and certainly we've been talking about what is going on financially in the country today. And remember that analogy that Stephen Roach used in his article that is dated October 26th, where he talks about the global economy like a plane, a 747, but it's only flying on two engines. One is the Chinese economy, which, of course, is producing. The other is the American economy, which is consuming. And what's going to happen, certainly, if the American consuming economy begins to falter? Because, you know, the Chinese economy cannot keep producing. If we don't buy, and then what will happen to China with its tremendous expansion that it has today? Well, it's going to be an interesting time. But all I can say is prepare for difficult times that lie ahead. I honestly believe that they are there. I do what I do because we're trying to educate the American people, and you know, I do it 5 hours a day. And of course, I do want to mention we are primarily a listener supported, and if you are in a position to help us, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and get our four best tapes and our monthly newsletter, why, give us a call. 1-800-544-8927. We hope many of you will go to our website and pull down our newsletters and read those newsletters through. Now, we actually have put them into small booklets, which are available through Radio Liberty, or at least many of them are. But you can simply pull them down, copy them, read them, and then check out the documentation that we have, and consider if these things could really be true, if there really are secret organizations out there that are energized by dark and sinister spiritual forces. And that is our basic contention. And how can we say that? Well, because the people on the other side say that. And if you'd like, of course, to read my treatise on the occult hierarchy, that's my May and June 2005 newsletters, available on the internet. If you don't have access to the internet, we'll be glad to send you the occult hierarchy part 2, which covers a book that was written by a member, well, a man who was part and parcel of the occult hierarchy, who was recruited into this movement by the most powerful man in the world. At least he says he was. He names who the man is, and you'll be fascinated by what his remarks, which we've reproduced in our book, and then of course his relationship to the former dictator of Russia, Mikhail Gorbachev, and of course Mikhail Gorbachev's background in spirituality and the relationship between Mrs. Gorbachev and Sai Baba, who is a mystic in India. And what does this have to do with anything? It has everything to do with it. Because, you see, there are people who can access the other dimension. There is a spiritual dimension of the world. And there really are people who can access that dimension. Of course, you do not want to do that, because if you did, why, you would be risking your very soul. But we are involved in a spiritual battle being played out in a political and ideological and cultural battlefield. And our job is to educate people about what that's about. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to. Go to our website, radioliberty.com, where you can hear our programs 5 hours a day on the Internet. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so, until we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us this evening, Derek Skousen of World Affairs Brief, and we're going to be talking about what's going on in the world. And believe me, exciting things are taking place. And, of course, the first thing I do every morning, you know, after I have my coffee and I do my early morning program on the American Freedom Network, and I read my emails first, and then I go to World Affairs Brief to see what's happening in the world, and then I go to work. If I can't get on World Affairs Brief, I almost feel, well, as if I have no idea what's happening in the world. It is a beautiful summary of what's happening in India, and I read the India and the Asia Times and certainly Reuters and what they're saying in the BBC. And you're not going to find out what's really going on in America by reading the American media. You're going to find out reading the foreign media, because our media is totally controlled. And you know, it's very unusual. You're going to get the truth out of the New York Times, the Washington Post, certainly the Los Angeles Times, or Time, or Newsweek, or U.S. News and World Report. Or ABC or CBS or NBC, but you'll find fascinating information there in World Affairs Brief, as well as, of course, reading the weekly commentary by Joel Skousen, Derek's father. And with that as the background, Derek, it's good to have you with us tonight.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. It's great to be here as usual.
Well, tell us what the really important things are in your estimation right at this time.
Well, we've got a tremendous amount of things going on in the news. This week we've been seeing news from a great deal from Syria, as Syria has been accused of assassinating the former president of Lebanon. And, of course, everyone knew that that's how it would work, but the accusations coming through the United Nations are setting up Syria for a set of serious sanctions.
Well, of course, basically, isn't this really an effort to force Syria to just change its form of government or face a threat of an invasion from the United States?
Yes, and that is part of a long-term strategy that we've been alluding to in the World Affairs Brief for the past few months. But it's interesting to see how that strategy, we think, has been changing and has been modified a little bit over the past few months. Kind of play down the all-out invasion aspect and try and play up a little bit the efforts of sanctions and working with the European government to put additional pressure to still get that same kind of regime change done there in Syria.
And, you know, of course, as I look at this, I really believe it's all part of this effort to put people into positions of power throughout the world who go along with our agenda for the New World Order. And the Assad of Syria certainly doesn't want to go along with that. I think a lot of the people, maybe the rulers of Saudi Arabia, don't want to go along with that. Certainly the leaders of Pakistan and India don't want to go along with that. But they're going to be forced to, as we begin to put pressure on any country we want to, and say, you're going to replace your government with the people that we want. This is what we did. Certainly in Rhodesia, and look how great things are in Rhodesia today. This is what we did in South Africa, and look how great things are in South Africa. This is what we did in Afghanistan and Iraq, and boy, we've created a utopia there. And we're going to be back in just a moment with Derek Skousen as we talk about what is happening with Syria, as we're threatening Syria if they do not do what we want. Well, Derek, how do you think that the Arab world feels about what's going on as far as Syria is concerned? And how is it that we were able to get the United Nations to investigate the assassination? Isn't this sort of a unique precedent when the United Nations, which, of course, we control and we finance, it begins to move into, into countries and investigate what's going on internally?
Well, it is a little bit of a unique precedent. But, of course, the Syria-Lebanon area is kind of a unique situation because of that basic, allowed control that Syria has had over Lebanon for, the past few decades, where Syria has basically been able to be a pseudo-dictatorship over another independent country, which was not independent at all. And so it's kind of an interesting situation that's been allowed to exist for a long time. Unfortunately, it's been very clear ever since the Bush administration came in that the situation in Syria, along with Iraq and Iran and the other nations or evil empires, as he put them, is not a situation that can be put up with anymore. And that's what's important to understand, is that Syria and Lebanon and that little narrow section of the Middle East has been something that's been created according to a previous agenda that has rolled forward, well, you know, extensively since 1945, but probably since World War One, and it has been created by a global agenda. And now we're seeing that agenda is shifting, where the relationship between Syria and Lebanon, instead of being propped up by the diplomatic, looking the other way that the West has put up there before, is now saying we need you to change. And of course, change does not happen to dictatorial countries like that easily. And so that change is going to be forced through. And the interesting thing is that the United States is trying to hide its play in enforcing this new agenda by moving it through a variety of fronts, including the Western European countries and the United Nations.
And certainly, what do you think is going to happen? Do you think that the Assad is going to simply give up his power and relinquish his rule of Syria, or do you think he's going to just say, we're not going to let you tell us what to do, which will eventually result in the same thing happening to Syria that happened to Afghanistan and to Iraq?
Well, it's very clear that that Assad is trying to backpedal and to get out of this basically this hot water situation that he's in at the moment.
Hold that thought for just a moment as we bring our other stations on right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Derek Skousen of World Affairs Brief, and Derek is simply saying that he is convinced that that Assad of Syria, the present president of Syria, who incidentally I think is an ophthalmologist who came back to take control of the country when his father died, but Assad is trying to backpedal and get out of this difficult situation. Where, of course, the head of Syrian intelligence is accused of being responsible for the murder of the former president of Lebanon, an explosion, a planned assassination, and the United Nations now has accused this former head of intelligence of killing this man. Of course, I don't know why they're so absurd, they're so concerned. The CIA has been killing heads of state, for many years. In fact, we interviewed a man this evening, on my afternoon program, who was talking about how he was asked to assassinate the Prince Sihanouk of Cambodia during the Vietnam War. So we've been doing this sort of thing for years, but suddenly we're so indignant when the Syrians have done this to the former president of Lebanon. Not that I condone either situation. It is all organized evil. But anyway, of course, we're now saying what a terrible thing to have done. So where do we go from here, Derek?
Well, the interesting thing to see what will happen is how the United States will push through this regime change in Syria, or if not regime change, certainly a major political change, without going to a full-scale invasion. And the reason why it's seeming less likely this month than it did last year or so that the U.S. would do an invasion into Syria is because the situation in Iraq is just sucking up so many resources right now, and is taking out so many resources from the United States. And the American opinion of that loss of resources has been so strong recently that we just can't start another full invasion into something like Syria just yet. And so what they're doing is they're pushing very strongly for a sanctions-based solution towards Syria. And in the meantime, though, of course, the agenda, though, is still rolling forward, and that agenda will still get done. The question is, well, ultimately, it's a matter of budgeting, except they're budgeting with our dollars and with our lives and with our futures.
All right, fine. Of course, this seems to have taken a little of the attention away from the fact that we've been doing everything we could to put pressure on Iran to give in to us. But I don't think Iran is going to roll over as easily as Syria would. Iran has a very good army. It has a good military. And I think it's got a lot of people there who are very, dedicated to their new leader, who's very hard-line in his treatment with the United States. And yet we seem to be intent upon toppling the Iranian government as well.
Yes, exactly. Iran is definitely much closer to to being a higher priority towards a more military-based solution than a sanctions-based solution, and that just simply comes from the way that the diplomatic strategy kind of rolls out. Syria, with its closer connections to Israel, Palestinian issue, and Lebanon, has a lot more diplomatic connections and United Nations pressure that can be put onto it. Iran, on the other hand, is a much different kind of situation, and we are seeing the U.S. responding to Iran in a very different way, responding to it in a large-scale military build-up way as they continue to build up bases surrounding Iran and building up diplomatic relations with India on the opposite side of Iran. So it's being surrounded militaristically and not so much diplomatically as we've been seeing in Syria over the last couple of weeks.
And I think every American should be concerned about our foreign policy, and I don't believe the administration's being honest with the American people. And you know, of course, they keep saying we're going to bring our boys home, and then the next thing we know, we see Condoleezza Rice saying, I wouldn't be surprised if our boys were there 10 years from now. And one of the generals recently said, well, you know, we're training the Iraqi army, but I just don't see how we can spend, turn over much of this battle to them, which means the Americans are going to have to continue fighting this battle because we dissolve the Iraqi army. Because Paul Bremer just accidentally dissolved the army and dissolved the police force and dissolved the civil service and created chaos. And then we said, gee, there's chaos here. And the people are unhappy. Well, we're just going to have to stay indefinitely until they can develop a new army. And we've been training that army for, I don't know, a year, 2 years now. And I don't think they might have one battalion that might work for fight, but every time they put them into battle, why, they always desert, because they don't want to be fighting other Iraqis.
That's right. And that was such a big story this week that came out, the senators asked Condoleezza Rice point blank, do you think it was possible that we could be out of Iraq in, give us 10 years? And Condoleezza Rice said no, effectively dashing the hopes of Americans all over that we could eventually be out of this situation.
And, of course, the president keeps saying, oh, he's so concerned about all the boys that are dying, but there was no need for any of them to die if he had told us the truth about the weapons of mass destruction.
That's right.
And the decision they made to go to war in Iraq was made long before the 9/11 attack. Anybody who doubts that has to only to go to the project, the New American Century website, newamericancentury.org, newamericancentury.org, and read the newsletters and the letters that Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney were sending to President Clinton in 1998, in the year 2000. Read the book by Paul O'Neill called The Price of Loyalty. He was the Secretary of the Treasury, and he said in January and February of 2000, of the year 2001, he was attending national security meetings with Rumsfeld and Cheney and Wolfowitz, and they were talking about how will we justify a preemptive attack on Iraq. It was all planned ahead of time. They just need an excuse. That's what's so frightening about this. And then to hear the president say, oh, we're so concerned about all the boys dying, when, of course, the war was planned long before 9/11. It had nothing to do with Osama bin Laden. They were simply that was the excuse for going into Iraq that they wanted. And that's what it was about. I would think that these people would have a difficult time sleeping at night.
Well, this pattern that you've just described there, I think, is very critical for all of us to understand. This idea that there is planning and there's a strategy that is set ahead in terms of this is something that we want to see accomplished. And yet, when it comes to a point where that strategy is put together, there comes a point where they need to have some kind of excuse to make it happen. Because there's that need built into that previous plan, when what happens, in this case it was 9/11, we have to wonder how much of 9/11 was also planned and part of a long-term and broader strategy. Now, I think that 9/11 has been used for many other things besides just that specific plan to go into Iraq. We've seen a tremendous amount of loss of liberties here at home. We've seen the takeover of Afghanistan and the creation of Homeland Security departments and so many other things out of 9/11. But we can see that there are a great many plans in place and a need for some kind of disaster to catalyze that plan. And so as we are watching the news and as we are carefully listening to the administration put together and suggest different kinds of plans that it will have in the future, then we start to fear for the kind of catalyzing disasters that may come up in order to implement some of those difficult plans. Some of the plans that we've been seeing in the news, and I'm sure that that listeners everywhere would recognize some of these plans when we talk about the military plans for the military to take care of to be in charge of disasters throughout the United States, plans for the federal government and the military to implement quarantines over an Asian flu kind of disaster, plans for a potential a draft in the being set up again and how that might be able to be implemented. All of these are far from actually being implemented here in the United States, but the plans are in place, and they're only one disaster away from being implemented.
Amen to that. Well, of course, certainly a lot of people are talking about some sort of a nuclear attack on here during Ramadan. Some of even our major organizations, major news sources, are putting this information out. Is this scare tactics, or do you think there's anything to it?
When it comes from the when nuclear attacks come from the major news sources, it's typically a scare tactic.
Right. In other words, it's propaganda to frighten us to death, so we really can't be affected.
That's right. It's designed to kind of build up additional levels of concern. In fact, the nuclear threat is generally underplayed in general by the major American media. It actually tends to be a little bit more overplayed by some of the surrounding media organizations. And the reason for that is that the nuclear threat is actually a real potential threat and something that people need to constantly be in preparation for. But that threat is kind of too big of an ultimate threat and is something that a small nuclear threat cannot be put through because it would prepare people too much for a final death knell against the United States.
All right, well, I guess this evening is Derek Skousen from World Affairs Brief. And if you have a computer, go to www.worldaffairsbrief.com first thing in the morning, as I do, and pull down the information that they have there. Derek and his brother and their staff gather information from all across America, and they get some of the finest articles there, things that I get from my other sources. We'll always see them there. We'll be on the very cutting edge of what's going on and preparing for the difficult times that lie ahead. Well, Derek, pick up the story from there.
Well, one of the things that we've been talking about here in World Affairs Brief this week has kind of been a summary of a great many economics issues. The economic situation in the United States is at a very difficult point. There are a tremendous amount of large-scale forces that are pulling and weighing down on the economic situation here domestically. So we've kind of summarized kind of eight major boat anchors that are hanging down on the economy here. Despite the efforts of innovative Americans throughout the United States, who are raising productivity, who are hiring people, who are trying to solve the problems of the disasters in the southern states, who are building their companies, who are designing new solutions and new products, and are generally boosting the economy in a variety of small ways, they cannot compete with these major eight boat anchors. And this is something that we've been analyzing here in the World Affairs Brief itself. And they start with, well, the biggest one is the amount of federal debt that is mounting up and the speed with which it is mounting up. Now, of course, this federal debt is directly tied to what we were talking about just a few minutes ago, the agenda that is being pushed forth worldwide and how that agenda is being built on the on the backs of the United States citizens through federal debt. We're paying for these tremendous costs of Iraq, and not just Iraq, but the U.S. military being extended throughout the whole world.
All right, and I certainly have went through that list of eight different the financial problems we're facing us. And do you want to go through those? I thought they were very, very well done.
Let's do that. So the first one is the massive federal indebtedness. And the second one is inflation. We've been seeing more and more about that this week, and we will be continuing to see that in the economic news as it moves forward. Inflation is moving up quickly. It jumped up about 5% last week, mostly due to the rise of energy costs. Of course, those official inflation numbers are very much underinflated, sometimes by as much as 100%. In other words, that the real inflation figures are probably double what they're being quoted.
In other words, the old idea, the figures don't lie, but liars figure, and they don't dare tell the American people how bad inflation is, and yet if you've got two brain cells, all you need to do is look around you to realize that prices are going up.
They really are. Prices are going up, and it's not just at the gas pump. It's it comes in the price of all the products, everything from lettuce to pencils. We're seeing these prices move inexorably up, and they're moving inexorably up faster than they did than they have been over the last few years, and that builds upon itself. Remember, inflation is a form of compound interest against our own personal savings and against our wages.
And certainly, then, of course, one of the things you talked about was the influence of globalism on the as one of the major things problems we face today.
Yes, that's right. In particularly, there's actually a couple of different parts to globalism.
Hold that thought right just a moment. We're going to bring our stations back on board just about right this minute. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Derek Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and he's simply talking about the eight financial problems we face today, and one of them, of course, is our massive federal and personal debt. Another is inflation. Another is globalism and the globalist impact upon our economy and our jobs and our factories. And so pick up the story there, Derek.
So, yes, the third one you mentioned is globalism and the constant outsourcing of core productions. One of the things that we're particularly concerned about here at the World Affairs Brief is not all of the, you know, say the global outsourcing of corporate consumer hotlines or programmers necessarily, but one of the things that we wanted to draw attention to was the loss of core industries of key production abilities in that threatens our long-term self-sufficiency as a nation. Basically, it's steel, machine tools, heavy equipment, electronics, cars, tractors, and even food. How so much of our farming and food now comes from overseas that we have less and less of the capability to take care of and sustain ourselves as a nation independently. And so we see that as a long-term risk and as essentially an anchor against this and a loss of flexibility in this turmoiled world that we are facing over the next few years. The fourth thing is big business legacy costs. This is a very big factor something that we are seeing in the news as we watch the bankruptcies of companies like Delphi, the major supporter of General Motors, a supplier of General Motors, of Delta Airlines, and the near bankruptcy of General Motors itself, a variety of very, very big companies are declaring bankruptcy or threatening to declare bankruptcy, and that's not just due to, you know, inflation in general, but it is very much a part of the big business legacy costs of the contracts based on union wages, the excessive health care benefits, the pensions. They're simply suffocating profitability out of some of the key sectors of our economy right now.
I think that people don't understand that General Motors is paying an hourly wage right at the present time of $68 an hour, which includes the wage, and of course about half of that is health benefits and pensions and all of these things. And with the pensions come the health care benefits after retire. They have 750,000 employees who are retired, and they're having to pay their pension, and they're going to have to pay their health care until such time as they get, you know, ready to accept the Medicare. But you can't do that. I mean, you're talking, you know, you're talking billions and billions of dollars that they're putting out for the retired workers who are not productive at all. And this is just a way down on their ability to turn a profit. And they're not only simply not turning a profit, they're losing money on every car they produce. How long can you continue losing money on every car you produce? And you can't. And one of these days, you just pack up your little bag and you move over to China where you don't have all these problems. And you say to all your former employees, all 750,000 of them, sayonara.
So it's a very serious issue. And you know, General Motors, you know, employs hundreds of thousands of people and is a major sector of our economy. But it's not just General Motors that has this kind of situation of long-term legacy costs with giant contracts with unions, with pensioners, with other government regulatory requirements and benefits situations. And so this legacy cost situation is weighing on the economy overall to such a large extent that it's very difficult for them to pull out or to even innovate out of this boat anchor of a profit situation that they're in. The fifth thing is that we are seeing some real scandals being hit over and over again in the companies that support the markets. We've seen the scandals associated with the mutual funds. Now we're seeing the derivative markets threatening to meltdown as the REFCO scandal is looking every bit as big as what happened to long-term capital management just a year or so ago.
Well, we're talking about a couple of $100 trillion of derivatives that are out there. And it was Warren Buffett who said derivatives are weapons of financial mass destruction. He said presently latent but potentially lethal financial weapons of mass destruction, pointing out that if the derivative market begins to unravel, our whole economy will begin to unravel. We'll be right back here with Derek Skousen. Well, this is Dr. Scan, our guest this evening, Derek Skousen. Derek, go right ahead and pick up the story there.
So we've been going through the eight major anchors that are weighing down the U.S. economy at this stage, and right now we're talking about the fifth one, which is the derivative markets, which are threatening to collapse with the recent REFCO scandal looking as big as some of the other financial scandals in U.S. history, as we've talked about the Wall Street insider trading, the long-term capital management scandal, and even going back to the savings and loans problems. And there has been a tremendous amount of scrambling over the past week or so to try and bail out REFCO and its holdings. And all of that scrambling and all of the money that is being pushed in to hold this together is creating a tremendous amount of uncertainty in the markets in general, and is weighing down on the economy overall.
And of course, if the derivative market ever begins to unravel, hang on to your hat. Long-term capital almost brought down the whole economy 3 or 4 years ago, and REFCO certainly has the potential to do that. And if one of them starts to go, they'll all go, unless, of course, the Fed intervenes, as they did frantically before, and, of course, they kept that. You know, they just made massive loans from banks and insurance companies to keep the financial house of cards afloat. Can they do it again?
Well, they're certainly working on it, and I think that's a key issue to understand is how much the Fed gets involved in buoying up the economy and trying to keep it going, trying to keep perceptions alive that that the markets are still being put together. In fact, in the brief this week, we have been talking about some news stories this week that confirm again, some of the things we've been talking about, how the U.S. government has a plunge protection team, and how they are primarily responsible for making sure that the markets stay together by injecting tremendous amounts of money into specific sectors. Of course, in the profit, as part of that, they're making certain people very, very rich who are aware of this plunge protection team, and other people are having to suck up the speculative bubble as it collapses.
And isn't that how it works? The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And if you're not privy to the knowledge of what the plunge protection team is doing, why, you can certainly lose your shirt and your undershirt, and the rest of your underwear will be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go pick up the story there. Derek is basically talking about not only the situation as far as the derivative market, where the Fed is moving in to try to keep this thing from unraveling because of the REFCO scandal. And apparently the head of REFCO just happened to have a $430 million loan. He just borrowed the money from one of the companies there, and it was accidentally picked up by a new auditor who pointed out, hey, how come the head of this company that is involved in this whole situation owes $430 million and was, of course, making some interest payments on that? And then was that was brought out, the whole thing began to unravel. And then, of course, Derek has begun to talk about how we have a plunge protection team, which is authorized by the government to inject billions of dollars into the market, you know, intermittently, and, of course, try to stabilize the stock market, and in so doing, enriches certain people on the inside and impoverishes those who do not understand that the markets are totally manipulated by the cabal that controls the finances of this country. Pick up the story there, please.
So, with all of this manipulation in the markets, it creates a lot of inefficiencies from an economic standpoint. And these inefficiencies show up essentially as speculative bubbles. And there are two major speculative bubbles of sorts that are threatening the U.S. economy and weighing it down and keeping it from being able to expand according to all of the innovative and entrepreneurial ideas that are out there in the United States. And so as we're going through our list of eight things, the sixth and seventh things are the real estate market bubble and the debt bubble in the United States, the high levels of consumer debt. These are important things to consider as the, because their effects are very, very real on the economy right now. Billions in federal spending to federal employees and contractors at home and abroad has been trickling down into the economy and inducing a rise in prices. Inflation has also been growing very strongly in the United States. We mentioned that as the number two thing that's weighing on the economy. All of those has been injecting money into where? Into real estate. People see land as being a place where there's protection against inflation, as a good long-term place to put money. And that is true, except that over the last few years, it's been happening so fast, and inflation has been growing so fast, and the manipulations of the markets have been growing so fast that there is now a flurry of activity which is creating a bubble in real estate. So what that leads to is as we're analyzing here on the World Affairs Brief, is potentially years of sub-market interest rates, years of very flat expectations in real estate outcomes. People are buying real estate now, expecting them to continue to move up in the double-digit percentage points as they have over the last few years. And that simply is not happening anymore and is not going to be happening again. And as those returns in the speculative market start to fall off, people will realize they are overextended. And that overextending leads directly to what I mentioned before, the number seven boat anchor on the United States economy. That is excessive debt by Americans all over.
And there are an awful lot of people who've gone out and bought homes that they couldn't afford with the idea that they were going to make money on it, the price was going to go up, and they couldn't lose. Well, of course, that's where you get into real problems, when you think you're in a situation where you can't lose. That's where you usually end up, of course, losing everything. So certainly this tremendous debt overhanging, average individual, people are buying things they just can't afford. In other countries, people don't go out on a limb, and they don't have all the credit cards. They don't have such easy credit, and people buying things that they can't afford, they don't want to realize that someday they're going to have to pay that back with interest.
That's right, and people all over the United States have mortgaged their homes with second, third mortgage, emptied their savings accounts, loaded up on credit cards, and now they're simply, they have nowhere to go as prices start to ramp up, as energy prices come in, how are these people going to pay if the cost of to heat their homes this winter goes up by 10 or 15%? Where is that money going to come out of the budget when they simply have to pay interest costs? And we're going to be seeing bankruptcies show up, all over throughout the economy because of this crunch between high consumer debt and increasing prices in the United States.
But, Derek, they knew exactly what was going to happen. That's why they modified the bankruptcy law. And if you don't, of course, go bankrupt by the 30th of October, 31st of October, you're not going to be able to go bankrupt as you did before, and you're going to be burdened with that debt for the rest of your life. So everything that's taking place, in my estimation, is planned. They know exactly what's going to happen step by step. They're anticipating it, and the way it works is the rich get richer and the people are impoverished.
Well, our hope is that by analyzing the news and by putting all of these little news stories that pop up here and there all around the world and putting them all in one place, we can start to anticipate this strategy that you're talking about going forward. And by anticipating, we can prepare and we can build ourselves a little bit of extra flexibility, hopefully a lot of extra flexibility, because I think we're going to need it.
Well, I think that you today have had a couple of excellent articles there. You had certainly an excellent article by Stephen Roach, the idea of what's happening economically and how the economy is like a gigantic 747 that's flying with two motors. One is the Chinese production and the other is the American consumption. But the American consumption begins to fall. You've got a four-engine plane. You've only got two motors really going for the whole global economy, which the plane represents. And of course, one engine is beginning to falter. And if our engine of consumption begins to falter, then what happens to China? That is an outstanding article. The other, of course, is Alan Greenspan's recent article talking about what's going on, in our economy as far as the energy prices is concerned. I think it was a talk he gave over in Japan a few days ago. And those two articles together give a very, very gloomy outlook for our economy. In fact, for the entire world economy.
That's right. And it's important to understand that not only is this 747 running on two engines instead of six, but it's also way overloaded. there's just too many other things packed into that airplane, and it's too heavy for what it needs to be. And now we're seeing it's not running on as many engines as it should have. I think that's an excellent example.
And I suggest anybody, if you see something written by Stephen Roach, read it. I think he's a brilliant economist. I think his analysis of what's going on is a very, very accurate senior economist there at Morgan Stanley.
So so as we've been putting together, we've talked about these, you know, these eight different anchors that are weighing down the U.S. economy. Actually, I should mention just real quick, the last one is, of course, the overextended stock and bond markets at this point, of how the PDE ratios continue to be much higher than they normally are. There's still so many trends that that indicate that we are still have a bubble even after the 2000-2002 shakeout in the markets. We recently saw this month Warren Buffett's discussion of the Berkshire Hathaway filings and his report, and everything that he's been saying is that the markets are still just don't have a lot of value in them, just like he's been saying since 1998. And so this excessive speculation that is still churning throughout many of the stock and bond markets doesn't allow us to see any sense of solidity in that area, and that sense of speculation means that it can be brought down more quickly according to all of these other issues that we've listed before. And so maybe before I move on, I can summarize I can list once again these eight different factors that are pulling down our economy at this stage. First is massive federal indebtedness. Second is inflation. Third is big business legacy costs. The fourth is the derivative markets threatening to melt down. The fifth is real estate market bubble. Number six is high consumer debt meeting with rising prices, especially crushing energy prices. And number seven, outsourcing core production from the United States, cutting down our flexibility to meet with future emergencies. And the last one, number eight, is the overblown stock market and overvalued bond market.
Okay, now before we go on, I just want you to get your telephone number out and your website out so people will know how to get in touch with World Affairs Brief.
Yes. If you want to get a free sample copy of these eight factors that are weighing down our markets right now and the other analysis from the news this week, give us a call at toll-free 877-518-5888. Again, that's 877-518-5888, and the folks there will mail you a copy of this analysis from the World Affairs Brief. And if you want to keep up with what's going on, this is actually emailed out on time every week, right at the beginning of the weekend, this analysis from worldaffairsbrief.com. And if you go there at worldaffairsbrief.com and subscribe, you can get our weekly analysis there on the news, or just for free peruse the news that we pull from so many different sources every day, and see all of these key stories come together in one place.
And really, it is fascinating. I learned something today I did not know from one of those articles on World Affairs Brief, and that was from an Indian website. Over in India, and they were just talking about how India and China consume 80% of all gold produced in the world today, that the Indians are buying gold very frantically, and this comes out of India. This doesn't come from, you know, someplace here. And, of course, they're really, of course, the only other great stores of wealth of gold are being held by our central banks, who tell us that gold is of no value, that the only really thing of any significance is the fiat money that they issue. And yet, isn't it interesting that all of the central banks have massive gold stores? And if it's no value, why are the central banks holding gold?
Yes, that's a key issue to understand, is that the United States, and not just the United States central banks, but central banks all over the world are frantically preparing to try and withstand future economic storms, which they are seeing by this economic situation that we just described, as it continues to build, and the continual difficulties of recovering from all of the economic manipulations and mismanagements that have been occurring for so many decades in the Western world. And this buying of gold is, of course, the first example of a preparation activity by these countries, especially by India and China, to have some kind of independence from the U.S. dollar, which has kind of been a de facto gold-like standard on the commodities markets for many decades in the past. But the fact that they're now actually going to the hard metal itself indicates that the dollar has some potential major future weaknesses.
And I think that Jim Poplava refers to this as the perfect financial storm. Everything is coming together, of course, that is going to create a storm like we have never seen before. Only it's not going to be a hurricane. It's going to be a financial hurricane. Jim Poplava's evaluation of the perfect financial storm, if you haven't been to his website, financialsense.com or org. I've forgotten which. I think it's financialsense.com. But go there, read the article on the perfect financial storm. Very, very similar to what Derek was just saying. You need to understand that you can already hear the wind whistling, you know, in the trees. But, of course, that just foretells the gale that lies just shortly behind.
That's right. And it's important to understand that this storm is already blowing, so to speak. Just as you say, Dr. Stan, the wind is in the trees. And in fact, the federal government here in the United States is scrambling to try and cover that the signs of that storm. It's kind of the opposite. You know, when we have a real weather situation, you can get on the Weather Channel, for heaven's sakes, and get minute by minute, second by second updates of what's happening and what's going to be happening. But now it's almost as if you can imagine the Weather Channel only predicting sunshine when a major storm is coming, and scrambling as people look out their windows and see the wind blowing and the clouds gathering, and turn on the television and you see the Weather Channel say, no, no, what you're really seeing is sunshine and everything's going to be great. But it's not just a media campaign. This effort by the federal government to hide the coming financial storm is being done not just outwardly in the media, but behind the scenes to a tremendous extent by gathering financial resources, by pouring out more debt into key areas, by propping up financial markets, by making deals with financiers and with big business, and so on and so forth. The federal government is actively working to manipulate and hold back the U.S. economy. Unfortunately, that increased manipulation is simply more and more of what got us into this stormy situation in the first place, and it will only exacerbate the storm when it finally breaks.
And I really fear that that it's going to happen no matter who's in charge. I think Alan Greenspan has timed his retirement at an excellent time, because I think it's going to strike just about January of next year when Alan steps down and poor Mr. Old Bernanke comes in as the new chairman of the Federal Reserve System, frantically rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. But it's not going to matter very much where the deck chairs are when the iceberg hits. Well, what are some of the other things you'd like to talk about there?
Well, I think it's useful to explain a little bit what's going on in the news. We're still seeing a lot of news stories about the Valerie Plame case, about how Karl Rove and Cheney and Scooter Libby are being built up for this future indictment. That's continuing to grow. We are also seeing in the news some concern about U.S. manipulations in the voting on the Constitution of Iraq. And so many other stories that are worth commenting on and pulling together here, which you can see at World Affairs Brief.
And I think that certainly there's no question at all that the government, our government, rigged the election over in Iraq. I mean, they had to get the Constitution through so they could set, oh, the Iraqi people want democracy. Well, you know, certainly we've rigged the election, for Mugabe in Zimbabwe. We rigged the election for Mugabe, certainly Mandela in South Africa. Why should we be surprised we rigged the election in Iraq? Well, go ahead, pick up the story. We've got three more minutes.
All right. So, in the in Iraq, of course, they have finally decided that the Iraqi constitution was officially voted for, and that the Iraqis have upheld the constitution, which they never really had a chance to read in the first place.
But my understanding is a lot of the voting places had a lot more votes than there were voters.
That's right. The officials have been investigating, or election officials are investigating what is called unusually high numbers of yes votes in dozens of provinces, and it's raising questions all over about irregularities in the balloting.
Why should we be surprised, though? But in Ohio, there was one precinct where there were only 800 voters and 4,000 votes for George Bush. And they said, well, it was a hiccup. It was a hiccup in the voting machine. If they'd rigged the elections here in the United States, why should we think that there'd be honest elections in Iraq?
That's right. One of the important things to understand is not only were the ballot stuff, but this election has a lot of core issues surrounding it that play into the future of Iraq, as we will see over the next couple of weeks. The bombings are starting to increase, and the status of civil war may be exacerbated by this voting situation, especially since the voting was close enough in many provinces to try and pull this constitution down. This constitution is, of course, very problematic from a liberty and democracy standpoint. It's not a democratic constitution at all. It's pretty much just a constitution in name only, and it's simply a piece of paper to try and legitimize the government that the United States has forcibly put into place there.
And I think what's so important is the Iraqi people weren't allowed to read the Constitution ahead of time because they kept changing it right up until the very last minute. How can you vote on something you haven't read?
That's right. You can't vote on something that they haven't read. You can't fix the vote. And you can't have a vote in a country that is so excessively polarized along such divisive parts of it that it can hardly be called a country at all.
Well, it isn't a country. It was put together by Winston Churchill back in 1918, 1919, so that they would always have instability there, so that the British could rule the country. Why don't we let the country break up? Why don't we let the people have their freedom and have their own individual countries? Why do we want to try to maintain an unstable nation, unless maybe we want instability?
Ah, but isn't that interesting?
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Derek and I could keep right on going here for the rest of the night, but we're out of time. Derek Skousen, thank you so much for being with us. Do you have a parting thought for our listeners?
Well, I just wanted to play off the comment you said about how the British created Iraq for long-term instability, and now the United States is recreating Iraq, seemingly for the same purpose, and it will be interesting to see how that purpose plays out on the global scale over the long term. Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night. God bless. Okay, well, our guest this evening has been Derek Skousen, who's always a pleasure to have here, and I hope you enjoy his commentary. I think it's so vitally important that you look beyond what you're told by the controlled medium and understand nothing as it appears to be. And when you understand that, then everything begins to make sense. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours a day. And certainly well over 35 stations. We're on at least an hour a day, but it's an expensive proposition, and we really look to you to help. And, of course, we did lose one of our major supporters recently, so if there's any way that you would be able to help, well, we'd appreciate it. Again, our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WARM. And then, of course, we hope that many of you, if you'd like to get a copy of perhaps our newsletter on peak oil, it's our latest newsletter, we'd be glad to send you a copy free of charge to understand how we've been totally manipulated as far as our belief that we're running out of oil. This isn't to say we're not going to have an energy crisis. This is not to say we're going to be able to get oil because it would take years to develop it. This is not going to be say that we're going to be able to open our refineries immediately because they've been closed, and the EPA will buck efforts to open it for a long period of time. This is not going to say that we can start drilling for oil because the Environmental Protection Agency, which is controlled by the oil cartel, will do everything they can to block additional drilling, both here off our coast or up in the Atlantic, in the Alaska Wildlife Reserve, ANWR, National Wildlife Reserve, or off the North Slope around Gull Island where there are massive pools of oil, probably far more oil than there is in Saudi Arabia. But you see, they don't want a solution. They want a problem because oil companies make more money when there's a shortage of oil than when there's abundance. It's just that simple. And when you understand the simple economics, everything makes sense. So if you'd like a copy of our either our September newsletter or our October newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll be glad to send it to you free of charge. You can go up on our website at www.radioliberty.com and pull down our newsletters. Please read them. You can archive our listen to our archive programs there. You can listen to our live programs 3 hours a day at radioliberty.com, or you can, of course, link to our other websites and hear them. That's the American Freedom Network and GCNLive.com. Remember, we're having an all-day conference here in the Monterey Bay area on the 19th of November, and we're serving lunch. We have to know if you're coming, so please give us a call, 1-800-544-8927, and then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, because we're on the front lines of this spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization until we're gathered again. May the Lord be with you.